We are continuing in our sermon series called Jesus is the True and Better. Now, if you haven't been around much, I invite you to go to our website and to listen to an audio clip that introduces our sermon series by fellow PCA pastor Timothy Keller. As this little spiel that's on a Vimeo web clip that gave us the idea for this sermon series. And Tim Keller reiterates what I've just been saying, that all of the Bible is not primarily or first and foremost about us. It's about Jesus. And through this sermon series, we've been looking at some of the main characters and some of the key events in Holy Scripture as these things unfold one epic narrative organically related that culminates in Jesus. We've been seeing the progression of the story as it unfolds, and not only how the Bible develops and moves towards its goal or conclusion in Jesus, but we're also looking at all of these initial events and key people in light of the Bible's grand conclusion in Jesus. Of course, this is how Jesus reads the Bible. It's how we as his people should read the Bible. Now, today we come to a well-known story, certainly one of our favorites, the passage about David and Goliath in 1 Samuel chapter 17. I was a little hesitant to preach on this passage because I preached a similar sermon on the same passage in December of 2009 here in the same church, not the same location. And I thought, well, I don't want to be too redundant and preach on the same thing. Melissa, my wife, she said, no one will remember your previous sermon. And what's more, it's just hard to not preach on David and Goliath. This is such a smashing story. It's so fun. It's just hard to resist the temptation as a preacher. So here we are. We're going to be looking at David and Goliath. We'll really order our time with two main portions. The first, we want to understand the story of David and Goliath. We want to read it for all of its worth. We want to immerse ourselves in this fantastic, smashing story. And then secondly, we'd like to stand back and to ask about the significance of this story. And we will conclude that Jesus is the true and better David. I'll start off reading then in 1 Samuel chapter 17. And we're going to be skipping around just a little bit. I'll read the first 11 verses, then verse 26, and then over to verse 31 through 50. This, then, we believe is God's holy word. 1 Samuel chapter 17. Now the Philistines gathered their armies for battle. They were gathered at Soko, which belongs to Judah, and encamped between Soko and Azekah and Ephes-Damim. And Saul and the men of Israel were gathered and encamped in the valley of Elah, and drew up in line of battle against the Philistines. The Philistines stood on the mountain on one side, and Israel stood on the mountain on the other side, with a valley between them. And there came out of the camp of the Philistines a champion named Goliath of Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span. He had a helmet of bronze on his head. He was armed with a coat of mail, and the weight of the coat was 5,000 shekels of bronze. He had a bronze armor on his legs and a javelin of bronze slung between his shoulders. The shaft of his spear was like a weaver's beam, and his spear's head weighed 600 shekels of iron. And his shield bearer went before him and stood and shouted to the ranks of Israel, "Why have you come out to draw up for battle? Am I not a Philistine? And are you not servants of Saul? Choose a man for yourselves. Let him come down to me. If he is able to fight with me and kill me, then we will be your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then you shall be our servants and serve us." And the Philistine said, "I defy the ranks of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together." When Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. Verse 26. And David said to the men who stood by him, "What shall be done for the man who kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God?" Verse 31. When the words that David spoke were heard, they repeated them before Saul, and he sent for him. And David said to Saul, "Let no man's heart fail because of him. Your servant will go and fight this Philistine." Saul said to David, "You are not able to go against this Philistine and fight with him, for you are but a youth, and he has been a man of war from his youth." But David said to Saul, "Your servant used to keep sheep for his father. When there came a lion or a bear and took a lamb from the flock, I went after him and struck him and delivered it out of his mouth. And if he arose against me, I caught him by his beard and struck him and killed him. Your servant has struck down both lions and bears, and this uncircumcised Philistine shall be like one of them, for he has defied the armies of the living God." And David said, "The Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and from the paw of the bear will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine." And Saul said to David, "Go, and Yahweh be with you." Then Saul clothed David with his armor. He put on a helmet of bronze on his head and clothed him with a coat of mail. And David strapped his sword over his armor. And then he tried in vain to go, for he had not tested them. Then David said to Saul, "I cannot go with these, for I have not tested them." So David put them off. And he took his staff in his hand and chose 5 smooth stones from the brook and put them in the shepherd's pouch. His sling was in his hand, and he approached the Philistine. And the Philistine moved forward and came near to David with his shield bearer in front of him. When the Philistine looked and saw David, he disdained him, for he was but a youth, ruddy and handsome in appearance. And the Philistine said to David, "Am I a dog that you come to me with sticks?" And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. And the Philistine said to David, "Come to me. I will give your flesh to the birds of the air and the beasts of the field." And David said to the Philistine, "You come to me with sword and with a spear and with javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hand. I will strike you down and cut off your head. And I will give the dead bodies of the host of the Philistines this day to the birds of the air and the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel. And that all of this assembly may know that the Lord saves, not with sword or spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hand." When the Philistine arose and came and drew near to meet David, David ran quickly towards the battle line to meet the Philistine. David put his hand into his bag and took out a stone and slung it and struck the Philistine on his forehead. So the stone sank deep into his forehead, and he fell on his face to the ground. So David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and with a stone, and he struck the Philistine and killed him. There was no sword in the hand of David. Blessed is the one who reads these words aloud. All right, so first the story of David and Goliath. Our story is set about 3,000 years ago in the early days of the Israelite monarchy. Israel was something of an unstable political nation, and it was surrounded by hostile nation states. And we hear many stories in the Bible about the hostilities and the military skirmishes and then sometimes outright international battles that occur between Israel and her enemies. Now, one well-known enemy nation-state that was just to the southwest of Israel, a much smaller country, a seafaring people on the coast there, was Philistia. Now, the Philistines, even though they were a much smaller company, were a warlike people. And not only did they have advanced military, but their weaponry was much more sophisticated and up to date than the Israelites. And they would frequently make raids into Israel and plunder Israelite cities, cause trouble, massacre Israelites. And on one such occasion where the army of Philistia, a group of men, is coming in to make raids, Saul, then the king of Israel, hears about it and goes out to meet them with his army. The way it happens, they are in an area where there are two mountain ranges. They're called mountains. To us, they'd probably be more like small hills, or large hills, rather, small mountains, smaller than the White Tanks, for sure, as an example. And the Philistines, they see the army of Saul coming, so they dig in high ground. And likewise, the army of the Israelites, they dig in on their opposing high ground. And there's a valley between these two armies. Now, it appears that neither of the armies, none of the men, are really too excited about going down and fighting the other in battle. But they also don't want to be the first to leave, right? And so they're camped in these two high positions, defensive positions, in something of a stalemate without any real means of resolving this skirmish. But there is one man who is ready to fight. He is a champion, Goliath, right? And so he proposes a not unheard of solution. He comes down into the plain, into the valley, and he says, "I'll fight your champion. Whoever wins, wins the battle. We'll be your servants, or you'll be our servants." Now, the catch is that Goliath is a giant of a man, right? He is like no man that this Israelite army of farmers would have ever seen. The Bible describes him spending some time on the appearance and the just amazing proportion of Goliath. It's almost like a movie camera picking up from the head and slowly going down Goliath. The first thing that we're told about is his incredible height. He stands far taller than any of the Israelites or than any man that they had probably ever seen. Now, in the ESV, the version that our church uses of the Bible, it says that his height was 6 cubits and a span. Now, in English measurements, that's about 9 feet, 9 inches. There is a textual variant with different textual families, meaning that some texts we have that are ancient report that Goliath was 4 cubits and a span, which would mean that Goliath was 6 foot, 9 inches. It's hard to tell which of these is accurate. No matter, Goliath was monstrous, right? Have you ever seen those? Now, biblical archaeologists, they report that in this day, the average male height was a little below 5'6". Okay? Have you ever seen those pictures of Shaq standing next to a normal-sized man, someone that's 5'8 or something? The normal men look just absolutely puny, don't they? And there's even a video clip of Shaq playing basketball in high school. And he just towers over everybody. And they're helpless before him, right? This is how the Israelites must have felt when they saw this muscular, enormous man, a giant of a man, Goliath. And what's more, it's not only that he's stronger and much bigger and has been fighting as a champion since his youth. He's also armed with a military technology that far exceeds that of the Israelites. On his head, he has a helmet of bronze. He's armed with a coat of mail so that anything, sword or spear or arrow that would hit him would be deflected. And he has a bronze armor on his legs to protect him, a javelin slung between his shoulders on his back. And the spear point of his javelin was 15 pounds, the equivalent of a modern-day shot put. You can imagine what that would do to a man hitting him in the chest. And what's more, he has an enormous sword and a shield bearer, someone with a life-size shield that goes before him and puts it before Goliath so that any projectile weaponry would be protected from it. Now, to appreciate the significance of all of this, if you've been reading in 1 Samuel, you need to recognize the military sophistication that the Philistines possessed that the Israelites didn't. These precious metals, bronze and iron, were common in Philistia, but were uncommon in Israel. So much so that only the elite or the nobility in Israel would have had anything like these sophisticated weapons that Goliath had that separated him from the normal people. So for instance, one example, 1 Samuel chapter 13, just a few chapters before this, we read that there was no blacksmith found throughout all of the land of Israel. The Philistines said, "Lest the Hebrews make for themselves swords or spears." So whenever the Israelites wanted to sharpen their plowshare or axe or sickle, they had to go down to Philistia to do so. The Israelites are largely farmers and ranchers or shepherds. They have a few plowshares and a few sickles, this kind of thing, but they're of much weaker and impure metals. And there are no blacksmiths even among Israel. This is a ragtag military armory of shepherds and farmers armed with sticks and stones. And they behold Goliath. And day after day, the first thing in the morning they see is this monster of a man. And he's cussing at them. He's cursing them. He's saying, "You and your God are nothing. Come down and fight me if there's a man among you. I'll feed your flesh to the birds." So the Israelites are in something of a predicament. It says here that they were dismayed and greatly afraid. And so the standoff and the taunts and the trash talking continue until we meet a young man, a teenager, perhaps 15, 17, by the name of David. David isn't even a part of the army. He's too young for that. He's tending the sheep of his father, but he's sent on behalf of his father to go visit three of his older brothers who are there behind the military lines and to bring them some rations, some cheese and so forth. And of course, David completely abandons the task which he was given, which is to take supplies to his brothers, and he runs right up to see where the action is, right? As you might imagine a young man being excited to do. And he hears this taunt from Goliath. And David begins to say, "Well, what will be given to the man who defeats Goliath? Who's going to address this insult?" He begins to speak in such a way that the hardened men of Israel who've been hearing this day after day are something, they're incensed with this young whippersnapper, David, right? Now, if you've been reading along in 1 Samuel, this is not the first time we've met David. Just a page earlier in 1 Samuel 16, David was singled out. The first king of Israel, Saul, has displeased the Lord. So God sends his prophet Samuel, and he says, "You will anoint for me a new and future king." And there is this elaborate meal where there's a double portion. And Jesse, David's father, who God has prophetically told Samuel, the new king will come from his family. He parades out his sons, the tallest and the oldest first. And the new king is not to be found. Finally, it turns out that David's actually not even there for the feast with the prophet. He's tending the sheep. So Samuel says, "Go get him." And they bring David in, and he's the one that's giving the double portion. And then symbolically, Samuel takes a flask of oil, and he breaks it over David's head. And you can imagine the oil pouring down. He is now the anointed. He is now literally the Messiah or the Christ or the King. All of these things are the same word. They mean the same thing. And we hear in 1 Samuel chapter 16, verse 13, Samuel took the horn of oil, he anointed him in the midst of his brothers, and then the Spirit of Yahweh rushed upon David and went with him from that day forward. So now we have a showdown, right? You've got the Goliath, the giant, and you have this young shepherd boy endowed with the Spirit of Yahweh. And Saul hears what David's been saying. He's desperate for someone to fight Goliath, and so he summons David. And you can tell from the passage that Saul is disappointed, right? He hears that there's a man saying that we should stand up to Goliath. He summons him in, and then he sees that he's just a boy. So David has to say, "Don't let your heart fail because of me. I will go and fight him." Of course, the king tries to equip David with his own military garb, but David's barely even able to walk. And so he goes out simply armed with a stick and now with his sling. Now, when I preached on this sermon, and when I preached on this passage in 2009, I started reading about slings, which I knew nothing about online. Now, who would think, but there are online forums of wilderness guys who hunt with slings and talk about their slings and this kind of thing. Now, slings haven't really advanced much since the time of David, 3,000 years ago, but still this is something people are interested in. And everyone recommended this book by Clifford Savage called Slinging Today for Sport and Survival. So I bought the book and I read the book. It was really interesting. And the technology for slings, like I say, it hasn't changed much. A sling is basically like a 3-foot strip of leather. And on one end, there's a loop. So you can put your hand inside the loop. And on the other end of this 3-foot strip of leather or rope, there's a little pouch. What people today do is they take a little piece of a rectangular leather and they wet it and they put it around like a baseball or a rock. So when it dries, it hardens. This pouch looks something like a cup, right? It's form-fitted. And then on the other side of this pouch, there's another 3-foot string, but woven into the leather or wrapped around the leather cord or rope is a ball or a rock. So what you do is you hold, you've got the rope around one wrist, right? And you hold in the same hand that ball. And you put a rock, and people like rocks about 2 inch in diameter, which is roughly the size of a golf ball, into that leather pouch. And then you begin to swing it like this, right? And it looks a lot like an underhanded softball pitch. When you're ready to release it, you let go of the rock toward the target, and of course the projectile, you let go of that end, handle, the round thing in your hand, and the projectile, the rock in the pouch, follows the rock that you've thrown that's attached to the sling. Does that make sense? Now, the ballistics on a sling, today, they've got studies of this, the ballistics on this rock, the projectile that the sling slings out, they're about 150 miles an hour, which is roughly the speed of a golf ball when a professional golfer strikes a golf ball with his driver. And the sling was a weapon as well as a hunting tool, of course, in the ancient world. And there's a place in the Bible where it talks about the slingers from the tribe of Benjamin. That they were so accurate with their slings that they could hit a hair, like a hair from your head. Now, certainly that's a bit of hyperbole, but the point is that these could be very accurate weapons. And from about 50 yards out, they could be deadly. You can even put a handful of gravel in the pouch and kill birds with a sling. Pretty impressive. So David, he's on the way out to meet the Philistine. And he grabs a handful of rocks, he put them in his little shepherd pouch, and he goes out, and the Philistine, this man of war since his youth, when he sees David, a youth, he is incensed. He despises him. He is insulted. "What, have you sent a boy to come fight me?" And they have this interchange where Goliath says that he's going to kill David, that the Israelites will be slaves, and that he will defeat David's God. David explains in verse 45, he says, "You come to me with sword, with spear, with javelin. I come to you in the name of Yahweh of hosts. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hand. I will strike you down and cut off your head. And I will give the dead bodies of the host of the Philistines this day to the birds of the air, the beasts of the earth." Why? "So that all the earth will know that there is a God in Israel. And that this assembly will know that Yahweh saves. The battle belongs to the Lord." Now, you know the rest of the story. David runs out to meet the Philistine, and he puts the rock in his sling, and his first shot is a bullseye. It hits the Philistine in the head, dropping him to the ground. David uses the Philistine's own sword to cut off the man's head, and there is a great victory for Israel. It's a fantastic story, isn't it? What about the significance of this story? How should we understand its meaning? Is there any lasting significance to this story? Well, certainly there is if you're one of the Israelites there this day, right? Because you were delivered from the Philistines, and this army was put down, Goliath was defeated. And there's lasting significance if you're a grandson of David, for instance, or if you were there at the battle and you can report about this great victory that you witnessed, even as it would be appealing to be the great-grandson of George Washington or something of that sort, right? There's lasting significance for the families that this event impacted. But what about beyond that? How is this story different from any other military skirmish that would have occurred 2,000 or 3,000 years ago? Is there any real significance for people like us who are otherwise unaffected by these people and these events? Many Christians answer that there is an ongoing significance and that it's to be found in David as an example for the people of God. You've probably heard sermons like this before. David is an example to us for his bravery, for his faith, and we should be like David, people that trust in God, people that have faith. And if we do what David did, then like David, we can be the hero. We can defeat things that seem to be overwhelming and impossible, the giants of our own life, whether it be overeating or alcoholism or debt or anything like that. If we just believe in God enough and are brave and entrust ourselves to God, then like David, we can defeat our worst enemies. Now, there is something to that reading of the Bible. David is exemplary in his faith, and sometimes the authors of the Bible themselves reflect on what can be accomplished, for instance, in Hebrews chapter 11, through faith, right? And David is a good example in this passage, and others he's a bad example, and the people of God can learn much from him in emulating him and being warned from his negative events. However, the key significance of this passage is not first and foremost to be found in David as an example. In fact, if you only read this passage in an exemplary way, where you stand in for David, then it is my contention that you have fundamentally misunderstood the Bible. The Bible is not about you. And this story about David, its significance is not to be found in what you might do. This is a story about the Christ. This is a story literally about the anointed of God, endowed with his Spirit, saving God's people from the hand of their enemies. This is a story about God's victory. You don't have to believe me. This is what David says. This is how David interprets these events. I will defeat Goliath. Why? So that the world may know there is a God in Israel. This is a story about the Christ, the anointed of God, sent by God to save, to deliver his people for himself. Of course, if you know the Bible, if you understand the way the Bible works, that it's first and foremost not about us, it's about God. And the first thing we ask when we read the Bible, like we're telling our kids, is not about what I should do or who I am, but who God is and what he's doing. If we appreciate that, then we see this story as one little part of an overarching story, one that unfolds or develops, that progresses forward. And we see that David, this is just one little iteration of an overall story, that this story foreshadows, anticipates, points forward to the overall story, the story of God being victorious, saving a people for himself, and ultimately using his anointed, the Messiah, the Christ, to save a people for himself. As we move forward in the story of the Bible, we see that Jesus is the true and better David. In fact, the New Testament is always laboring to show us that Jesus is the rightful David, that he's the second David, or the one which succeeds where David failed, that he takes up his seat on David's throne, that he's David's heir. He is the anointed. He is the Christ. He's the Messiah. He's the king. He accomplishes what David could never accomplish. He's victorious where David failed. The first page of the New Testament. This is the genealogy of Jesus, the Christ, the son of David. That's the first sentence of the New Testament. And as the Bible introduces Jesus to us, it tells us that all of Israel's history, all of the history of the Son of God, that is the people of God, Israel, is subsumed and leads us to this one who is the true Son, who is Jesus. Verse 17, all of the generations from Abraham to David are 14 generations, from David to the deportation to Babylon, 14 generations, and to the Christ, 14 generations. This one who is the son of Joseph, the husband of Mary, of whom is Jesus, he is called the Christ. The birth of Jesus, the Christ, that is the Messiah, the anointed, it took place in this way. And whenever someone begins to understand Jesus in the New Testament, one of the ways we see that they get it is that they call him the son of David. So the blind men, they call out, son of David, have mercy on us. And Jesus recognizes, they get it. They know who I am. The Bible itself speaks about Jesus in this way. There are many examples, but here's one climactic example from the book of Revelation, the end of the Bible now. Weep no more, the angel says. Why? Why is there no more cause for weeping? The root of David has conquered. David's greater son has been victorious. Jesus is the Christ. And through his anointed, God is victorious over the worst of his and the enemies of him and his people. Jesus' victory, of course, is not over a small band of raiders, the Philistines. It's over the ultimate enemies of God that stand behind even the Philistines or the Romans or any other temporal enemy. It's over sin and Satan and death. The Philistines will come again. In fact, David will be fighting them all of his life. But Jesus' victory is permanent. It's unquestioned. It's ultimate. The Bible leads us toward this Christ, the heir of David's throne, through whom God defeats his enemies and saves his people. The Bible is not about you, and David is first and foremost not an exemplary figure. Now, if you think you're the hero of the story, if an Israelite thought that, they would get squashed by Goliath. You die, right? You can't fight Goliath. But we're not the heroes of this story. God is. And that means recognizing that now, understanding first and foremost what the Bible is all about. That means that we can have faith, participate in even the victory of Jesus. What's interesting is after David single-handedly defeats Goliath and cuts off his head, all of the Israelites now are emboldened to run forward and to participate in the victory that is theirs because of their king. Of course, the same is true in the Bible if we were have more time to look at it in the New Testament. Jesus has landed the decisive death blow against his and our enemies. And now because he's the hero, he's the victor, it means that even the people of God have a part to play, that we now participate in Jesus' victory. We reap the benefit of it, and even that God uses us in following the Messiah, his son. My friends, this is good news indeed. In the story of David and Goliath, one part of this unfolding narrative of the Bible, we're reminded about what God would do in Jesus. And in Jesus, we see that he, the true and better David, has been victorious over all of his and our enemies. Now we have been saved by him and have newness of life in which we might live for our King. Would you stand with me? We'll pray together. Oh God, we thank you for David. We thank you for the way in which through this shepherd boy, a teenager, and through a sling, you defeated a giant. What's more, we thank you for the way in which in this story we see that you are delivering your people through your anointed, that you will be victorious over all of our enemies, over all of your enemies, that you save a people from the worst of threats for yourself. We thank you for the way that these truths resonate and grow up into the story of Jesus, where the true heir of David's throne ultimately delivers a people of God against their worst enemies and has now vanquished the foe, cut off its head, and been victorious. We praise you for this, Lord God. Be pleased now among us, your people, as we continue to worship you. And we shall ask it in Jesus' name. Amen.